Hello and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood, and we're looking to review most weeks at this time at the worlds of economics and politics. Two guests up today. First, in a few minutes, we'll hear from Diana Furchtgott-Roth on the economic advantages of a liberal immigration policy. And then we'll hear from the Israeli-American writer Joel Shalit with a critical point of view on the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement against the Israeli occupation of the West Bank and Gaza, inspired by a recent controversy at Brooklyn College. But first, some of the economic news. I haven't commented on the monthly U.S. employment reports in a while. It used to be a natural when this program was broadcast on Saturday morning, since the numbers are released on the first Friday of every month. No longer. But these are important numbers. Not only are they sensitive indicators of the general state of the economy, the job market is also what matters most to almost all of us, those of us who aren't retired, rich, or off the grid. Employers added 157,000 jobs in January, 166,000 in the private sector. That's about a third below the long-term average rate of job growth in an economic expansion, which is what we're in, even if it still feels like a recession. Construction, which had been weak for years after the housing bust, was strong, perhaps goosed up by Hurricane Sandy reconstruction. But other sectors were less impressive. Manufacturing, which was on something of a tear for a while, was just modestly positive. Private services added jobs, but at a rate well below recent averages. Temp employment, which used to be a harbinger of future employment trends, a relation that might not hold anymore because of the proliferation of permatemps, temp employment was down. Government employment continues to shrink, with federal and local employment leading the way southward. Average hourly earnings rose, and although growing modestly by historical standards, they're doing rather well by recent standards. It's hard to tell whether this is an effect of the changing mix of jobs or people are actually getting raises, but it's certainly better than falling wages. These figures come from a survey of about 300,000 employers. The simultaneous survey of 60,000 households came in weaker. Though in principle, the two surveys should tell the same story, they sometimes contradict each other over the short term. The household survey had employment down. Sometimes it's quicker to pick up on changes in the cycle, so this decline bears watching in the coming months, in case things really are weakening. My guess is that we're still in a grinding recovery from a major financial crisis, and not on the verge of a second recession. But you never know, and you have to let the evidence speak to you. The unemployment rate rose a tenth of a point to 7.9%, and people continue to drop out of the labor force or choose not to enter or re-enter it because the job market is so crummy. If you're not actively looking, you're not counted as unemployed, but out of the labor force. We're making slow progress at recovering the jobs lost in the Great Recession. At the pace of the last 6 months, we'll be back to the previous high in a year and a half, not allowing for population growth. The employment population ratio, the ratio of those employed to the total adult population, is 4.3 percentage points below its pre-recession high. At recent rates of employment growth, it would take almost 5 years to get back to that old level. In other words, we're still deep in a hole, meaning it's a real social emergency, yet all politicians can talk about is getting the deficit down. Okay, on with the show. First up, Diana Furchtgott-Roth. She's an economist and a fellow at the Manhattan Institute and quite right-wing. She's just written a paper for the Institute arguing that we need more immigrants because they're good for the economy. You will hear just how right-wing she is and what follows. I don't do this often, but every now and then it's interesting to go spelunking about those precincts. Before writing me indignant emails about letting her air her views, be assured that I don't share her position on bilingual education. In fact, I think it would be good if everyone, most of all native-born, native English-speaking Americans, got bi or even trilingual educations. And before disclosing to me that her right-wing comrades want to encourage immigration only to cut wages, recall that her argument, and the consensus of many economists who study the issue, is that immigration doesn't cut wages. Diana Furchtgott-Roth. You're a strong believer that immigration is good for the American economy. Give us some sense of why.
That's right, yes. It has positive economic effects. If you look at some cities, for example, that at the end of the 1700s were comparable in importance, such as New York City and Charleston, South Carolina. Now New York is the center of the country financially. Some people say it's a leader in the world, along with London and Tokyo and Hong Kong. One reason is because of all the immigrants that came to New York rather than Charleston.
Now let's review some of the arguments against immigration, at least the economic ones to start with. The standard critique is that it depresses the wages and possibly the employment of native-born American workers. What do you say to that?
Well, it's not what I say, but economists' analytic evidence, empirical evidence, has shown that immigration raises the wages of native-born Americans. First of all, immigrants have complementary skills to Americans rather than substitutes. So you find many immigrants who don't have a high school diploma. You find many with PhDs in math and science. American skills are in a more of a bell-shaped curve. There aren't many American adults without a high school diploma. There are not very many with PhDs in math and science. So we find that this makes the economy more efficient. Immigration makes the economy more efficient because there are jobs that fill skills that Americans don't have.
Economists like George Borjas, himself a Cuban immigrant, have argued that immigrants depress the wages of American workers on the order of 5 to 10%. What's your reputation of Borjas's work?
So there are other economists such as Pia Arrhenius and David Card who've shown that immigration raises wages. And yes, for low-skilled Americans, the wage might go down somewhat, but given the overall wage is higher, then transfers can be used to compensate the losers. Borjas, in one paper, suggests that there are more African Americans in jail because of immigrants, but with the withdrawal of African Americans from the labor force started before the wave of immigration. Borjas's work also has found smaller effects on wages of native-born Americans with each successive paper that he's written. But there are many other economists who find the opposite conclusions. I think everyone would admit that at the low-skill end, those native-born Americans are more likely to be affected, but the actual greatest effect of immigrants on wages is other immigrants themselves, because immigrants are a substitute for other immigrants. But interestingly enough, one finds that most immigrants are very pro-immigration.
You alluded to this earlier, but as I recall Card's work, he found that in studying, comparing cities, he found that those with more immigrants tend to be more dynamic than those with fewer.
Right, exactly, yes. So, for example, if one could think of some way to get immigrants to come to Detroit and buy some of the inexpensive houses that are there right now, one could see that immigration could really rejuvenate Detroit. And there are many people all over the world who live in dangerous environments, whose children and families are in danger of being kidnapped, who would be happy to buy a house in Detroit. There are also entrepreneurs who want to come here and create jobs. There's a special e-visa for entrepreneurs. And these e-visas should be expanded. And if an entrepreneur creates jobs for native-born Americans, he is then given a green card after a certain number of years and allowed to stay. And that's a win-win proposition for us, because the immigrant comes, we can see how well he's doing, and if he succeeds in business, he can stay.
Immigrants are disproportionately likely to start businesses, right?
That's correct, yes. And the Kauffman Foundation for Entrepreneurship has done a great deal of work on this. What we want to be sure is that we don't drive immigrants, talented immigrants, to other countries which have more favorable policies. So it's easier, for example, if you are an immigrant scientist, to get into Canada than to get into the United States. We want to make sure that the best and the brightest come to the United States.
A more popular argument against immigrants, one you hear from politicians but also in barrooms across the country, is that unlike earlier generations of immigrants, the current crop, mostly from Latin America, do not assimilate. What's the truth of that?
So that was a complaint in my paper that I wrote for the Manhattan Institute. I have a historical section where there are complaints throughout America's history that immigrants are not assimilating. There have been complaints against Irish immigrants, against Italian immigrants, against German immigrants. And these complaints against Hispanic immigrants are just one in a series. Now, of course, many people who are against Hispanic immigration look at German or Italian or Irish and say, oh, those are fine. Well, probably in a certain number of years, people are going to say Hispanic immigrants are fine, and they're going to object to whatever the next group is. The Manhattan Institute publishes an index of immigrant assimilation by Duke University professor Jacob Vigder, and the latest research shows that assimilation is increasing rapidly. Immigrants are increasingly assimilating. Research by Doug Massey at Princeton University also shows the same thing. But I would say that the United States is not helping immigrants to assimilate, and we should look at our own policies and how they are affecting assimilation. We shouldn't be providing bilingual education. We shouldn't be providing bilingual ballots. We should make sure that people who come here find it as easy as possible to learn English. Every immigrant, when he comes here, wants his children to be able to learn English, and bilingual education is not helping that.
Well, the children do learn English pretty rapidly, but it's a polite accommodation to the parents to make it a little easier on them, isn't it?
I think that students who speak a different language should be put right away in an English-speaking school without any bilingual education. If a parent needs a translator in a school meeting, that's another thing. But all the materials, all the teaching that their children should get should be in English. That way they will learn English faster. The process of assimilation will be increased. In fact, there are people who come here from other countries specifically to learn English. They pay to go to American schools. They want to become fluent in English. We shouldn't deprive immigrant children of these same opportunities.
I'm speaking with Diana Furchtgott-Roth, who is a fellow at the Manhattan Institute and an author of a paper that I've just done on immigration and the effect of immigrants on the U.S. economy. Now, let's turn to the issue of the H-1B visa, which typically brings engineers into this country from abroad. A lot of American engineers will complain that employers just want to import cheaper foreign workers because they don't want to pay American-scale salaries. On the other hand, the companies say that they have no choice and there just aren't enough American engineers available to hire at any price. How do you sort this out?
So the thing about the H-1B visa is that it does tie the visa recipient to a particular employer. So that means that that particular employee is, so to speak, at the mercy of that business or that employer. A different visa structure that would allow the engineer to come in but would not tie him to that particular employer, I think, would be preferable. Because then if that person thinks that they're not getting a high enough wage, they would be able to go and try other employers.
And now the post-9/11 world requires a lot of immigrants, H-1B and otherwise, to jump through a lot of security hoops, right?
That's right. And even tourists have to jump through security hoops. You know, it's difficult for people in China to get tourist visas to visit the United States, so we are losing a lot of tourist traffic to places such as Singapore.
And what about students who want to come here? Are they suffering similar restrictions?
Students also have to go through security hoops, and we need to, with all the information we have, with all our electronic technology, with all the apps that software makers are making for the iPhones, we should be able to speed up this process. We should be able to do checks, background checks, in a faster manner so that we can let people who want to come here who have no criminal background, who have no terrorist connections, they should be able to get their visas faster. Tourists also, by the way. And then others should be denied their visas, again, in a speedy manner. There is no reason we can't be speeding up this process. And in fact, people who are detained here on immigration violations have to wait sometimes a year or more before these are resolved.
And now a demographic angle. We have an aging population, the baby boomers, my people, aging into retirement and wondering who's going to finance their pensions. What would higher rates of immigration do to solve that problem?
Immigrants traditionally have higher fertility rates. And so more immigration would increase the overall American fertility rate. And this would be very favorable for our Medicare and Social Security programs. We need a growing population, not just to fund our retirement security programs, but also because it increases economic growth. More people come, they want to buy more goods, businesses can expand, it's good for everybody.
We've seen a slowdown in rates of immigration in recent years, a combination of a weaker economy, fewer jobs on offer, a much less attractive target, but also a growing political and cultural hostility to immigrants. Has this had a negative economic impact? Is it slowing down our economic recovery? What do you think?
So immigrants tend to come when there are jobs, and then when there aren't jobs, they leave. And it's been a very difficult job environment in the United States. We have unemployment close to 8% right now. Our job creation rate has been very slow. So that's the major reason that we are seeing not just fewer immigrants, but many people who came here before are going back to their own countries because they think they can do better there. We need to speed up economic growth in a variety of ways, not just to help native-born Americans, but also so we get healthy economic growth.
I was reading a paper by the economist Robert Gordon the other day, and he says, in a footnote, citing unpublished work of his own, that high rates of immigration tend to correlate with high rates of economic growth in American history, and vice versa. Does that comport with your thinking?
It does, yes, yes. And I'm not sure he talked at all about the causality, but when we have high growth, we have more immigrants that come. And then these immigrants start businesses. There's a lot of economic activity. They buy goods, they buy services, and the American economy grows faster because of them. Again, if you think of the comparison of New York, which had many immigrants, and Boston, with cities that didn't, such as Charleston, you get the idea as to how much immigrants help growth.
And finally, what about the politics of this issue? Immigration seems like a pretty difficult sell in the current political environment, although that might be changing, I don't know. But how do you think you might change some minds and make Americans friendlier towards welcoming people from abroad?
Well, I think that I am an economist, and so basically I do think that economic arguments change people's minds. And I think that the positive economic effects that immigrants can have on our economy will help change politicians' minds. And I think one especially good example are these entrepreneurs who want to come here and found firms and create jobs. I think it should be win-win letting them have visas. Maybe even if we can't have what's called comprehensive immigration reform, we can pass bills that allow certain groups to come in, such as high-skilled workers. We know that we need more agricultural workers to help with different crops at different times of year. We should be able to get a bill passed that does that. We know that children who have grown up in the United States and who have high school and college degrees but who don't have the right papers should be able to stay here. We should be able to pass that. So it might be easier to go for a series of small bills than one large bill.
I was Diana Forkgott-Roth, a fellow at the Manhattan Institute and author of a paper published by that institute on the virtues of immigration. I think she's largely right in the positive economic effects of immigration. I certainly don't agree with everything she said, like compulsory monolingualism. You're listening to KPFA and KPFB in Berkeley, KFCF in Fresno, and on the web, kpfa.org. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program is Behind the News. Back after a musical break.
Drive our ships to new land, fight the whole.
Yeah, that was Led Zeppelin. Next up is Joel Shalit, but first some background. At the end of January, a firestorm erupted around plans to hold a panel discussion at Brooklyn College on the movement to boycott, divest from, and sanction Israel over its occupation of Gaza and the West Bank, the so-called BDS movement. Though first organized by a student group, Students for Justice in Palestine, the Political Science Department signed on as a co-sponsor, and then much chaos ensued. The very invocation of the letters BDS is enough to send Zionist fanatics into a rampant state of rage, and this was no exception. Several New York politicians, with Jerry Nadler, the very liberal congressional representative for the West Side of Manhattan, in the lead — he was my congressman for many years, and he's mostly as good as mainstream politicians get — they wrote a letter to Karen Gould, president of Brooklyn College, objecting in strong terms to the very idea of holding the panel. The headline on Nadler's website captured the flavor of the letter: "Progressive Brooklyn and Citywide Elected Officials and Leaders Letter Regarding Brooklyn College Endorsement of Anti-Israel BDS Event." Well, a couple of misstatements in that headline. Brooklyn College didn't endorse the event. The Political Science Department co-sponsored it, which isn't the same as an endorsement, and that doesn't constitute the entire institution of Brooklyn College. And BDS isn't anti-Israel, it's anti-occupation. Details, details. Nadler's letter was signed by a number of political figures, among them my current city council rep, Letitia James, who's been a guest on this radio show, and whom I've talked with around the neighborhood several times. She's otherwise very impressive, a smart and principled person who's also about as good as mainstream politicians get. I was seriously distressed to see her name on this. A day or two later, several members of the city council wrote a letter to college president Gould threatening to pull funds from the college. Clearly, major political figures were trying to influence the discourse in a public university, which is nothing less than an authoritarian move. Also involved, the odious Alan Dershowitz, the bullying Harvard law professor, whose resume includes attempts to suppress the publication of a book by Norman Finkelstein that, among other things, revealed Dersh as something of a plagiarist. Dershowitz wrote a letter to every member of the board of the New Press, slamming Finkelstein's reputation. The press got cold feet, causing him to take his book to the University of California Press. Dershowitz then called up Arnold Schwarzenegger and tried to get him to suppress the book. Arnie refused, and the book appeared. Dershowitz, who of course hates the very idea of BDS, took the line that it was unfair to have a panel on the topic with only two people who more or less agree with each other. Instead, he argued both sides of the issue should be aired. Dersh himself had given a lecture at Brooklyn College, his alma mater, only a few years earlier, that defended the use of torture, with no opponent around to balance his stand on a controversial issue, but apparently the principle of balance applies only in certain circumstances. Faculty members in the Political Science Department, including the chair, Paisley Kura, and my good friend Corey Robin, who's been on this show to discuss his book in The Conservative Mind, organized a defense campaign, which lobbied, among other people, the signers of the threatening letters, the president of Brooklyn College, and even Mayor Michael Bloomberg. And you know what? They won. President Gould wrote a strong letter defending the principle of academic freedom, despite the threat to withhold millions of dollars from her college. Several signers of the letters withdrew their names, among them my representative, Letitia James, an effort to which I'm proud to say I contributed. And then on Wednesday, Mayor Bloomberg strongly defended the principle of academic freedom and told the meddlers to buzz off. There are many things wrong with Bloomberg, but every now and then he surprises you pleasantly. There's something about having $25 billion that allows you to speak more freely than you might otherwise. Anyway, despite all this, I'm still not sure what I think of the BDS movement. It's odd for Americans, whose government funds and arms Israel, to sign onto a boycott targeted at another country besides our own. Shouldn't there be a BDS movement against the United States? Not only that, but focusing on Israel occludes the degree to which the U.S. has supported other hideous regimes, many of which have crumbled or are in the process of crumbling now, across the Middle East. The greatest act of solidarity with Palestinians that we could undertake would be to end U.S. financial and military support to Israel. Next to that, boycotting Israeli hummus seems trivial, and as we'll hear from Joel Shalit in a moment, boycotting Israeli cultural and educational institutions could be seriously counterproductive. In any case, the attempt to suppress the panel has actually drawn more attention to and provoked more conversation about the issue than if the opponents had kept their mouths shut and allowed the panel to proceed in obscurity. appointed the shrewd bourgeois Bloomberg, to steal a description that Ernest Mandel applied to John Maynard Keynes, noted in his comments on Wednesday. So I thought it would be good to solicit the perspective of a frequent guest in Behind the News, Joel Shalit, the Israeli-American writer and editor, who has impeccable anti-Zionist credentials. Joel's most recent book is Israel vs. Utopia from Akashic Books, and he's an editor at the webzine Souciant. Joel Shalit. Welcome, Joel. As you know, there's been quite a controversy at Brooklyn College about the panel on the Boycott, Divestment, Sanctions Movement, BDS, against Israel. What's your opinion of the BDS, leaving aside the fact that no one should stop an academic panel from happening? So, you know, that's something we agree on, no argument there. But what's your opinion of the BDS movement, its analysis of the situation and the strategy?
I can only speak about it as an Israeli, really, because obviously you have a different experience of BDS from that context than if you were an American Jew or a diaspora Jew. Obviously, the concerns of Palestinian solidarity politics in general touch people differently depending on where they're from. In my case, I have found myself generally sympathetic to most Palestinian solidarity activism. There's not much to disagree with in principle with Palestinian solidarity activism. Palestinian solidarity activists are fighting for equal rights for and civil rights for Palestinians in the occupied territories and in certain cases in Israel proper. They are seeking independence and or a single binational state in what's called Israel-Palestine. There is a cultural distinction, though, that Israelis and some diaspora Jews tend to feel exists between the way that BDS advocacy gets expressed by diaspora activists and BDS advocacy gets expressed by indigenous Middle Eastern activists. And I think, to be even more specific, there is a particular kind of culture around BDS activism in the United States that is distinct from what you find here in Europe, in the United Kingdom, in Germany, and in Italy, the three countries which I know best from having lived and worked in them. And I wrote extensively about the rise of Palestine solidarity politics in the United States in my book Israel versus Utopia from the years, many, many, many years I lived in the United States. I was just speaking about Palestinian solidarity activist culture with an Israeli-American friend of mine last night in Philadelphia, who's quite active in the anti-occupation movement there. And he was saying, you know, something, he put into words something that I felt, which is that there is a kind of construct of the Middle East and a construct of the Palestinians amongst many American solidarity activists that make us feel uncomfortable. There's a fetishistic quality to it that we tend to find similar to that which we experience with Christian Zionist constructions of Israelis and Jews in the Middle East and their alleged struggle with the Arab world. And it leads many people in our position to wonder whether there is a general American problem with Middle Easterners that has more to do with problems associated with American guilt for imperialism and general American identity politics than it necessarily does have anything to do with the Middle East. And that it similarly reflects the unbelievable impotence that has been forced upon American activists in regards to Middle Eastern questions than they necessarily are clear on or recognize. And this is said, again, as people who, though they are also much immersed in American culture themselves, are also somewhat outsiders. And this is not uncommon to the sort of criticisms you hear from persons more involved in more dedicated, like left-wing and anarchist circles in Israel and Palestine when the internationals come to join protests and exhibit a certain kind of naivete towards everybody that the locals would just wish they would get over. I'm 100% in favor of every bit of pressure that the outside world can apply to the occupation. But there are points of cultural dissonance that exist within the greater left focused on the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, and these points of dissonance, these moments of alienation, tend to be a consequence of where you come from and what your experiences are.
One of the things that struck me is the complexities of Americans' involvement in the BDS movement. Given the deep role of our government in financing and arming Israel, but also our broad involvement across the region in other ugly ways. What do you think of that?
In terms of?
It would seem to me the first duty of an American trying to exercise solidarity with Palestinians would be to change our government policy.
That's right.
Boycotting Hamas or refusing to go to conferences at Israeli universities seem almost trivially weak and far down on the list of things to do.
I've never been in favor of the cultural boycott and the academic boycott. I haven't seen what use that ultimately serves when, for example, it's of enormous significance to have Slavoj Žižek or Judith Butler come and speak at an Israeli university. It's not always clear to American solidarity activists how closed Israeli culture has become in recent years and how much censorship exists in both media and academia that prevents critical voices from the outside world coming in to help explain the nature of the situation that Israel is enmeshed in. The Israeli right tends to think that it can hermetically seal Israel off, not just from the Middle East, but from the outside world in general. They have a very censorious and very Brave New World kind of attitude towards what kind of information and what kind of media Israelis ought to have access to. And while they have not necessarily exercised the kinds of censorship that you see in countries like China, for example, yet at the same time, every effort is made to create an affirmative intellectual and media culture that supports state policy. So we need people coming into the country who are going to criticize the social and political norms. And boycotts, cultural boycotts that specify that people like Jello Biafra can't come and give a spoken word tour or bring his band to play don't do anyone any good.
No, but what about the argument this is to remind Israelis of what pariahs they are internationally? And
totally.
I think Israelis are rather aware that they're pariahs internationally, aren't they?
They are, but it's a culture of a rather remarkable and distinct kind of denial. On the one hand, let me put it this way. We have to live with a lot of denial simply to be able to live with the Palestinian question, simply to live with a lack of resolution to the Palestinian question, simply to live with the level of massive human rights violations that we have to reconcile ourselves to as long as the Palestinian situation is not resolved adequately, civilly, and in favor of a two-state solution at this point in time. And so that denial tends to get displaced in regards to foreign criticisms of Israel in very similar ways. The outside world isn't critical of Israel for justifiable reasons that have to do with our foreign policy or our conduct towards Israeli Arabs or our treatment of minorities in the country. It has to do with anti-Semitism. It has to do with the fact that the outside world is all about double standards and that Europe hasn't changed since the Nazi era, And it's a constant critical stream of communication towards Israel, towards all Israelis, will ultimately relieve them of that situation. But it's something that's not always done effectively, and it's something that's not always done with an eye to how to break down Israeli denial and Israeli inhibitions about listening to the other. Boycotts are in my opinion, simply the wrong strategy with which to deal with that issue altogether.
Deb, what about the analogy that people draw to South Africa, that the sanctions were crucial to dismantling apartheid, and that the cultural boycott was an important part of that?
I would say that in the Israeli case, the cultural boycott is not as crucial as the kinds of selected boycotts that are conducted in the diaspora in regards to Israel. So, for example, you look at the Caterpillar campaign that Jewish Voice for Peace conducted a few years ago. These kinds of campaigns highlight and target very specific entities related to the military situation and the way in which foreign industrial products are used to support the occupation and persecute the Palestinians. And I think that those are justifiable campaigns to support. Again, as I said, the problem with the cultural boycott is that, it shuts out critical voices that need to be going to Israel and educating Israelis about what's wrong with the situation. So on the one hand, while I can understand why a band like the Pixies, for example, might find it within their interest to, not go and play in Israel because they have moral problems with the occupation, they're not going to Israel isn't as much a big deal as Judith Butler not going to Israel, because Judith Butler is directly engaged in addressing questions revolving around Jewish identity and support for the occupation. And so those kinds of intellectuals need to be free to travel without the criticism of the anti-occupation left.
Now, Butler's argument is that she refuses to have anything to do with institutions that are not explicitly opposed to the occupation, so she won't go, for example, to Tel Aviv University. You think that she's making a mistake?
I think that those institutions are more complex than that, and I think that there are a lot of students at Tel Aviv University who would benefit from hearing Judith Butler. But that's not to say that students from Tel Aviv University won't go to a squat to hear her talk if, sufficient advertising in Tel Aviv is available to alert them to Judith Butler coming in, giving a workshop or something. But as a whole, universities are always complicit with all the structures of domination and all kinds of horrible corporate interests in every given society, but there are also places in which critical education does take place in spite of that. That's her choice. I generally prefer her voice on these matters over other left-wing intellectuals engaged in the kinds of criticism she's engaged in the United States.
I'm speaking with Joel Shalit, who is one of the editors of the webzine Souciant and also author, most recently, of Israel versus Utopia from Akashic Books. You said that the boycott was not an effective way of dealing with Israeli closure and paranoia. What would be a more effective way to deal with it?
In regards to the Israeli public sphere in general, I think that it's very important that Israel be discussed in foreign media, and it's very important that foreign intellectuals who have criticisms of the occupation and have criticisms of Israeli democracy and have criticisms of Israeli multiculturalism and have criticisms of Israeli state policies on civil rights and equality be able to address the country directly, be able to travel to the country directly, and be able to engage Israelis directly, because the situation in the country is such that there is an increasing demand for political conformity and uniformity in its media and its educational systems and in its popular culture. There are enough persons outside of Israel who understand the country and understand its politics and understand its history well enough to be able to help break through that situation at present. Israel cannot be allowed to cut itself off from the outside world intellectually and culturally. It is part of the outside world. It is the outside world in its own ways. And it sets a terrible precedent in the West and as well as in the Middle East that Israel may be able to detach itself culturally and ideologically from everything outside of it.
You have a very dark view of the current political configuration of Israel, right?
It's not positive, yes, of course.
give the listeners a measure of just how bad things are.
The last 4 years of the Netanyahu government have witnessed an expansion of the power of right-wing extremists in Israeli government and Israeli civil society, to the degree that many Israelis and many foreign Jews are worried about whether Israeli democracy will survive and whether Israel can ever espouse the same kinds of social democratic liberal values identified with the West at its best. The Netanyahu's success in moving the country to the extreme right to the degree that he has in the last 4 years is the culmination of an effort he has waged since the early 1990s, if not since the 1980s, when he served in Likud governments in Israel, to disable any kind of peace process that might be at hand and to create, a country that was run by a constellation of theofascist settler types and neoconservative economic types. Netanyahu has been a very savvy coalition builder between all of the various different facets of the Israeli right over the last three decades, and he doesn't have any effective opponents in Israeli society, not of whom can prevent him from continuing to expand on and refine the logic of the political revolution that he has led in recent years.
What in his dreams, in his utopia, a frightful thought, would happen with the Palestinians in the occupied territories and the domestic Israeli Arab population?
The ultimate consequence of Netanyahu's policies are that the Palestinians will just go away, that we will eventually be able to empty Israel of its Palestinian population, and whatever happens to the Palestinians outside of what becomes Israel's borders is their problem. And it is not an explicitly genocidal view, but it is a dramatically extremist position nonetheless. It is absolutely merciless in its view of Palestinian rights and of non-Jewish rights within Israel proper.
How could people go away from territories that they're penned up in?
The Arab Spring is largely the Israeli right's worst nightmare come true because the level of unrest that exists around Israel is inspires a sense of fear and foreboding about what the future of the region holds for Israel. And where the Palestinians fit into that, they don't know, but they see an enormous threat in what kind of role the Palestinians might find themselves playing in such an unstable and diffuse regional scenario.
Now, you said not explicitly genocidal, but by the one aspect of the classic definition of genocide, the destruction of a culture, that's certainly on the agenda, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. It is. But the industrial aspect of it that we're familiar with from Europe is not necessarily there. It's a slow grind. It's a slow grind to the end of Palestinian existence. And you look at Gaza and you look at, the fact that people have been wasting away in these refugee camps, in Lebanon, in Jordan, in Syria for the, since 1948. And this is their desired future as far as the extremist position on the Israeli right is concerned.
And the extremist position is becoming increasingly mainstream.
The extremist position has become more mainstream than anybody ever imagined it would be. And certainly though Yair Lapid, the new savior of the Israeli center who polled so well in the most recent election, is supposed to be interested in reinvigorating the peace process, Lapid doesn't necessarily offer a dramatic deviation from the current vision, and his platform is not progressive in the slight at all. It's more like a throwback to the Oslo period, when we imagined ourselves both being able to live in occupation and outside of it. There is no imagination on the part of the Israeli right, and there is no desire on the part of the Israeli right to create a tenable situation for Palestinians outside of what they imagine Israel should be.
I think there's a fantasy on the Israeli right that it could go on its own without the money and weaponry coming from the United States. Is there anything to that?
This is a subject that has been raised in recent years in a number of quarters. Netanyahu himself, over the last decade, has suggested weaning Israel off of American military aid, and more recently, Naftali Bennett, the leader of Chabad HaYehudi, a new settler-led right-wing party in the Knesset, has argued this as well. Ironically, both Bennett and Netanyahu are two of the most American politicians Israel has ever had. So you have to look at who's doing the talking when these issues come up, and ask why on earth they're raising it. Does it necessarily have to do with ideology, or does it have to do with their own anxieties about being identified with the United States? It's a little bit of both. As far as practical proposals to this effect, Avigdor Lieberman, until recently Israel's foreign minister and the head of Israel Beitenu, had been advocating in no uncertain terms that Israel consider realigning itself with the Russians over the United States, because the Russians are closer politically in terms of Putin's government with Israel. That Putin is often seen as a model statesman for Lieberman and, to a lesser extent, Netanyahu, also because the divergence culturally and politically of the two countries in the view of the Israeli right was just too great to imagine being indefinitely dependent on a country led by an African-American mixed-race person. It comes down to those kinds of factors. This said, the Israeli military tends to be of the opposite opinion, and one cannot discount the degree to which the Israeli military's opinion is half of the political opinion in Israel. They tend to be more in favor of remaining closely tied to the American government.
All right, and finally, are there any straws one can grasp at for hope, or is this situation just careening towards further grimness?
The results of the Israeli election, though they did not shake out ideologically in any convincing way for liberals, mean that there's still some play involved within the Israeli democratic polity that simply spell out that a savvy political organization with convincing leadership can slowly build a new left in the country that's distinct from what exists now and has existed in past decades. My sense is that if that's ever going to happen, it's going to take a long time, but the amount of voter intimidation and the amount of ideological discouragement from participating in the Israeli electoral process, typical of authoritarian societies of the one that the Israeli right has been trying to grow, did not pan out as they had planned. And to that extent, There's hope, but otherwise it's a long, hard road that Israel and the Palestinians have ahead of them.
I was Joel Shalit, an editor at the webzine Susiant, and author most recently of Israel vs. Utopia from Akashic Books. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Let's go out with this from the Israeli punk band Dir Yassin, Salvation at the End of a Barrel of a Gun. The band, which flourished between 1999 and 2002, named itself after the site of a horrid massacre during the 1948 war, during which Jewish militias, including those led by future prime ministers Begin and Shamir, killed more than 100 Palestinians. Obviously, the band didn't use the name as an endorsement of the massacre, but as a rude reminder of the country's brutal origins. If you don't like hardcore music, you might want to hit the off button now, because these guys are serious. They refused an interview with the magazine Punk Planet, which Joel Shalit used to work for, because they thought the mag was too mainstream. Here are some of the lyrics of the song they're about to sing. You are only following orders, breaking bones, tearing families apart, blowing up houses, denying building permits. It's all part of the job of protecting national security. The real enemy is not the Arab, but the myth of the Zionist soldier. Okay, till next week. Bye.